me from here. I didn't ask to be broken. I didn't ask you to stroke my hair or treat me like a worthless token. But my skin is thick and my mind is strong. I am built like my father was. I've done nothing wrong.
No mai, haere mai, ko Sandra Kailaho, and you're with Safe and Sound, New Zealand's animal rights radio show. We broadcast from Free FM in Hamilton, and we're proudly sponsored by Village Organics in Commerce Street, Frankton. Well, today we're speaking with American animal activist Wayne Shung, whose organisation Direct Action Everywhere is making a big splash in the animal rights movement. I spoke to Wayne earlier today. Welcome to the show, Wayne. Thank you so much for coming on to Safe and Sound.
Hey, it's a pleasure and an honour.
Now, Wayne, you've said that, I read somewhere, you said that every animal that you meet instantly becomes your best friend. And but have you always felt friendship and empathy for animals? What part did they play, for example, in your childhood?
I have, and they played an enormous role in my childhood. I grew up in central Indiana, which is not in particular the most progressive or diverse place in the United States. It's a very conservative area of the country. My dad emigrated to this country with his new wife as a young graduate student. They immediately got a job in central Indiana, and I didn't have the best time when I was growing up. I was a kind of a geeky immigrant kid. I had broken glasses, chubby, I wore terrible clothes, and I was bullied pretty mercilessly at school. And so I found companionship in the animals. And almost every day when I got home before I got a dog, I'd just walk through the forest and pretend the squirrels and the birds and the lizards and the frogs are my friends. And then when my parents finally allowed me to adopt a dog when I think I was 8 years old, she instantly became my not just my best friend, but my most important family member. Mm. And to this day, I say that she was my hero. For the rest of my life, I've dedicated to fight for animal rights, partly because of my interactions and my relationship with my first dog, Vivian.
So it was your relationship with her that started you, either consciously or unconsciously, on a life journey to fight for animals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every time I'd come home from school, no matter how hard my day was, I'd come home from school pretty regularly just in tears from the bullying and the teasing. I mean, people would call me a fat kid. They'd make fun of my little eyes. And they'd say the nastiest things to me, because kids can be cruel to each other. And no matter how hard my day was, I'd come home, and Vivian would run up to me, barking like crazy, jump to my lap, knock me down, and we'd roll around on the ground together. Yeah. And no matter how many tears I had in my eyes, yeah, it invariably bring a smile to my face. She's my hero. I mean, she really saved my life, and everything I've given back to animals is just a really small gift to give back to the animals that have given so much to me.
And the devotion that animals, and let's just talk about dogs for a moment, because everyone knows how loyal dogs are, but no matter how imperfect we are as human beings, and we all are to a greater or lesser extent, our dog just thinks that the sun shines out of us.
Absolutely, and it's not just the dogs. All the domesticated animals give so much back to us. One of the most difficult things about being an animal rights advocate is learning more about how, over the past 10,000 years, we selectively bred these animals, like pigs, cows, and chickens, to be gentle and social and sensitive. A wild chicken or a wild boar is a very dangerous animal, and you cannot approach them. They will not be friendly. But you give a domesticated pig a belly rub, and she'll grunt. You pick a baby pig up when she's feeling cold, she'll snuggle up against you. And I know this because I've had these experiences with animals now for the past 10 years of my life. Every interaction I have with these animals just inspires me to fight even harder. And it's the one, and frankly, at this point, the only mission I have in my life, to help as many animals as I can. You know, a wild bull in Africa, where cows are originally domesticated, is one of the most dangerous animals on the plains. It's thousands of people are mauled by these animals every year. But every single generation, you select out for the most gentle and sensitive creatures. Within just a few generations, you can change the characteristics of these animals dramatically. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we've done, not just with dogs, who originally were wolves, but with pigs, who are wild boars, and chickens, who are jungle fowl and very fearful and fierce animals in Asia. We've selected out all the aggressive characteristics from them, which is why you have 700-pound farm pigs who are more scared of us than we are of them.
The thing is that farm animals still are afraid of us, aren't they? And, of course, with very good reason.
Yeah, they're afraid, and they're big babies, you know. They're, you know, childlike animals of any species do. And there's actually a process by which biologists have named the process by which we've created these infantile characteristics. It's called neotenization. we basically selected for childlike characteristics in these animals. They have big floppy ears, clumsy feet, you know, big eyes and big faces. You know, a domesticated pig, even at the adult stage, looks a lot like a baby pig in the wild. Just like baby animals in the wild, they're sensitive, they're sweet, they like affection. And of course, the worst part is we've done this to them and then we've betrayed them by brutalizing them in horrible farms.
It's that sense that they begin to rely on us and they begin to depend on us and, I suppose, to a certain extent, trust us, and then we'd betray them.
It's disturbing how often you talk to people in the industry who say, oh, we care for these animals, we love these animals, we care about animal welfare, and at the end of the day, no matter how humanely they're treated, they're still going to have that terrible death, filled with fear, filled with desolation, and ultimately with the end of a life that did not have to be ended. And that's not right. And we all understand this when it comes to dogs and cats. If somebody said, you know, I gave my life 3 good years, and now it's time for me to beat her to death so I can eat her.
Yeah.
I mean, I come from a country where they do that. And Europeans and Americans widely revile the practice of dog meat because we understand that every dog is an individual. Every one of their lives is precious. But the same is true of pigs, cows, and chickens. And our mission as animal rights activists is to show the world that all these animals are equal and all of them have the capacity to suffer and the yearning to live.
This is why Direct Action Everywhere DXE exists. Tell us about when and how you started it.
We started Direct Action Everywhere in January of 2013, and this was a time where across the nation, and frankly across the world, there were massive grassroots mobilizations. It was an era of social movements, from Occupy Wall Street to Black Lives Matter. People on the streets were seeing the power that they had to change the world, and we wanted to take those same methods and tools, not just from modern social movements, but frankly from the past 50 years of social movement research and practice, and apply it to animal rights. One of the things the animal rights movement has been missing, I'd say especially in the past 15 years, is powerful grassroots mobilizations, making ordinary people and volunteers feel like they have power to make change. The reality is, this world can only change if we mobilize masses of people. It's enough to have nonprofit organizations. It's not enough to have a few celebrities and politicians endorse our movement. We need mass mobilizations. And the reason we know this is because every time in history, there has been a big systemic change, whether it's civil rights, women's rights, or gay rights. It's because masses of people have hit the streets and brought attention to a cause that had previously been ignored. And we made that our mission at DXE, to create a mass movement for animal rights and inspire ordinary people across the world to speak and fight for the animals who have so little power to speak and fight for themselves.
But why do we have to have direct action? Why don't we just persuade people to become vegan, tempt them by, you know, meat substitutes and food that is delicious but just happens to be vegan? You know, and we can even as vegans be an example to others.
I think all those pieces matter, but what we found through history, and I've been a scholar of history and social science for the past 15 years of my life, is that over and over again, nonviolent direct action is the most powerful weapon of social change and social movements. That the only way for you to mobilize masses of people to change over a very short period of time is to use disruption to generate attention, inspire more people, and then eventually enshrine the change you're trying to create in an institution. For the first 5 or 6 years of my life as an activist, I was under the impression that I was going to play my small role by convincing as many people to go vegan as I possibly could. What I started realizing is that in many ways, it's kind of like fighting against a wave. You can push as much as you want against the waves that are crashing into the beach, but the wave has its own power. And what you have to do is reshape the nature of your ecosystem and change the way people make decisions in the first place. We can't just change people one by one. We have to change the landscape in which they're living because there's so many marketing influences, cultural influences, political and legal influences that shape the decisions that people make. And I first realized that I went to China for the first time and saw dogs being eaten. It's not that the Chinese were different people. It's not that we're a different species. It's that we're taught different things. The norms and institutions and laws and cultures in which Chinese people grow up in are very different from what Europeans grow up in, and so they see dogs as food. Well, we see pigs, cows, and chickens as food, and the only way to change that is to build a movement that can reverse some of these norms and institutions that are really indoctrinating us to do and think and say and eat things that if we actually reflect upon our practices, we realize these things are not consistent with our own values. They're not consistent with the compassion that I hold in my heart for animals.
The law follows movement and society. It doesn't make it, does it? And so when the people raise their voices for change and when change begins to take place, that is when lawmakers make laws to accommodate it. Do you agree with that?
I do. In one of my former schools, MIT, one of their mantras is that no one's ever changed the world by following the rules. Sometimes a rule, a system is so entrenched, a rule is so corrupt that the only way to create change is just to break it, to say, hey, you may be saying that we're not allowed to expose the cruelty in this industry. As the industry has said with these ag-gag laws that have been passed across the country, that we believe we have the right to know. And we're going to go right into these farms, right into these slaughterhouses, and take those photographs anyways, take the animals out and show the world exactly what you're doing. You may believe that animals are just things and that you can torture them, have them be diseased and cannibalized, but we believe they're living creatures that have the same feelings as our dogs and cats. We're going to walk right into your facilities and take them to the vet. And it's when people believe that they have the right to do these things, the system actually changes. And the only way to show that you really believe that you have the right to do these things is to go and do them. So if we believe that we should have the right to take care of an animal that's being abused by a factory farmer, we have to just go in and take that animal out. And if enough people do this, the world will change and the rules will change.
Often the law is an ass, to repeat the old saying. I'm sure you try to be law-abiding when you enter into a huge chicken shed or a pig farm. It's not the farmer standing there giving you the keys, right?
It absolutely isn't. And, I mean, nonviolence is absolutely crucial. And the key thing to note about nonviolence, and I'm a Buddhist and I practice a Hindu too, is that nonviolence is not about the absence of violence. It's about challenging violence when you see it. So when we go into these farms and we don't ask for permission, we just walk right in, we are acting out of compassion and love. And all of us know that if you truly love someone, when they're being hurt, you defend them. If your partner, if your child, if your father or your mother is being beaten or is being abused or bullied or harassed, you step in and intervene, nonviolently, if you can. And if we truly have love for animals, and I really believe that people do love animals, the best way for us to live up to those values is to practice nonviolence, not just by passively declining to participate in the violence, but actively trying to challenge it. And we talk about direct action everywhere. The classic definition of direct action that Gandhi and King used in their practice of nonviolence was challenging injustice. That is what nonviolence is. It is actively intervening to stop violence and injustice, and that's why we started direct action everywhere.
When you're in a factory farm and you have rescued a baby pig who its whole life has only known darkness and frustration and fear and has lived its life on a concrete floor, or a chicken who is so thin and brutalized that the chicken's shaking in your hands. What do you feel, Wayne?
Well, we feel two things. One is we feel enormous sense of loss and regret that we can't take the other animals out. And I am so inspired by the SAVE movement. And I think many of us have had the same interactions when we bear witness outside of these horrible places, and that we do have these momentary connections with the animals. And we apologize. We say, we're doing the best we can. We're going to try and do better. But it inspires us to do more. But the second thing you feel is when you get out and you get to watch an individual recover, it really does inspire you. It gives you strength to do more. And you realize there is hope. And that kind of outlines a crucial difference between what sociologists call empathic distress and empathic concern. And the reaction, where initially you'd see animals in distress or suffering and you want to turn away, this is the most common reaction that people have. The vast majority of human beings on this planet, when you show them animal suffering, they turn away. And the reason they turn away is because it hurts them. But the problem is they don't see a solution. And sociologists call this empathic distress. When you feel empathy for someone who's suffering and you think there is nothing you can do about it, then your natural reaction is to run, because you run in the same way that you'd run from your own suffering. If I felt pain, if my hand was being burned by a fire, I'd run away from the fire. The thing that keeps people fighting over the long term is shifting empathic distress to empathic concern. And the difference between empathic distress and empathic concern is having a path forward, having a solution. And open rescue gives us not just an opportunity to bear witness, experience the suffering the animals are experiencing, empathize with them, but also it gives us a path forward. Embodied in using this individual animal rescue as an ambassador for all of them, we can see how we can change the world in the life of this one animal who recovers. Because if we can take one animal out, we can take another. And if we can take another out, we can take another after that. Eventually, if we inspire enough people, we can rouse so many rescues and inspire so many people to take these forms of nonviolent direct action that the industry is forced into a titanic battle. Because the more scrutiny there is of this industry, the more we have discourse over the industry's practices, the more we showcase what's happening and have a public dialogue about what's actually happening, the more people will be won over to the cause and the faster the system will change.
The animals that you rescue, it makes a difference to that one animal. But it is symbolic, isn't it? Because the action itself will have a resonance. It's an act of bravery and compassion that is in itself a symbol of how we could relate to other beings. For me, what we do to animals in such astronomical numbers is a great, great moral wrong. But the problem is that the majority of people who are good people, as you say, they'll turn away from animal suffering, but they haven't made the connection yet. They don't see it that way. Yeah. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, there's an old adage from many different cultural traditions, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, that when you save one life, you save the world. Yeah. And you're right, that there is symbolic power in the act of rescue. And when you take out that one life from a factory farm that has 10,000, 100,000, or sometimes even a million lives that will be tortured and that will be ended by a violent system, you often feel powerless initially. And then you see people's reactions when they have an individual story. You see hundreds of thousands of people sharing this on Facebook. You see tens of thousands of people hitting the streets at the March of Closed All Slaughterhouses or at the DXC Forum at these big mobilizations. And you start seeing the world changing piece by piece, person by person, city by city, state by state, nation by nation. And that inspires you. That is what keeps me going every single day. And I've been an animal rights activist for over 15 years now, and I've done some of the most dangerous things you can do as an animal rights activist. I've gone to China and been beaten up and jailed. I've been threatened by the FBI in the United States, investigating one of the biggest pig farms in our nation. And people ask me, how do you not get scared and not burn out? And the reason I don't get scared and I don't burn out is because I can see that path forward. I can see that when we save that one life, we are saving the world. And we will get to the point where every single one of those animals is released from that slaughterhouse and they're all taken to sanctuary. And that vision is worth so much to me that all these small sacrifices I'm making are really trivial in the scheme of things.
You have a sense of urgency. So if anyone says, okay, well, things will change with time, chill out, and all will be well, what do you say to that?
I mean, every hour, tens of thousands of innocent beings, just like our dogs and cats, just like my little boy, Oliver, are being utterly brutalized. And so there is a sense of urgency, and especially when you're out there on the front lines as often as I am. And last year, I was in the field about half the entire year. So day after day, I was seeing animals being caged, animals being mutilated, animals being mercilessly slaughtered. So there is this sense of urgency, and we need to cultivate that because this is a movement of allies. We're not the ones who are being victimized by these abusive industries directly. And we are being victimized indirectly by antibiotic resistance, environmental damage, all the health impacts of animal agriculture, abuse of slaughterhouse workers and people of color who live near factory farms and slaughterhouses. So we are being abused indirectly, but we're not the primary victims. And so it requires us to empathize and see what it's like to be in the animal shoes. But we can do this because we know we can do this because we've seen historical movements that have succeeded as movements of allies, whether it's the anti-slavery movement, the movement for juvenile justice. When people realize that someone who they love, someone who they care about, someone who could be a family member of theirs, could be brutalized by an evil system, they will rise up against it. And that's what happened with some of these movements. Whether it's anti-slavery, juvenile justice, or more recently the gay rights movement, where there are many straight folks like myself who fought very hard because we had friends, we had family members, we had loved ones who were being endangered by this system of oppression. And once we start seeing that urgency and start seeing solutions to the problem, then I think we'll see a mass movement rise up and change the entire world.
You're a really inspiring leader in the movement, but I'm wondering how can I say it, you guard your heart. At the end of this interview, I'll be playing a track called Speak Out by Jason Oliver, and the words, it burns my heart to see them suffering, to hear them in misery. Yeah. I cannot be silent. I mean, this is the other part of it, isn't it? It is painful, but in a way, doing something is better than doing nothing.
Absolutely, and this morning, I had to send an article that I wrote about the dog meat trade and the investigations and rescues we've done in Yiling, China, and I was in tears just thinking about all the dogs they'd left behind. I just couldn't believe, you know, the images and videos that I was watching, and I knew they were true because I shot them myself. These are scenes that I didn't just record with a camera. I was there, present, seeing dogs being beaten. I mean, dogs no different than my dogs. And, you know, I thought about the fact that one of my dogs at home, Oliver, was going to be beaten to death on a concrete floor, dragged off the slaughterhouse to have his throat slit and carved up for someone to eat. And that's just unconscionable to me. It's hard for me to imagine. But every day when I get up, I think about things like that. But when I walk over to Oliver, and I say to him every day, I'm so proud of you, Oliver. Thank you so much for being here for me and with me and for fighting so hard for your life. Because I find so much inspiration by the Resistance to Animals show and the resilience that they have. And Oliver And if you look at the video footage we shot in Yiling, China, he was hairless from mange, had parasites that were filling up his intestines and his stomach to the point that while he was starving to death, his tummy was as big as a watermelon and had been beaten and abused and terrorized his entire life for 1 year. And today, he loves his papa. He loves his mama just like any normal dog. And it's not that he doesn't have a lot of trauma. He does. He's going to have trauma for the rest of his life. But he's a normal dog in so many ways. And I see in his recovery hope for the entire world. Hope for me to recover, too, from all the traumas that I've been through. And if Oliver can overcome that, everything he's overcome and live a happy, joyous, and peaceful life, then surely the entire world can change, too.
Wayne, you're such an inspiring person to speak to. And you will have some advice for fellow activists. Even though this is an animal rights show, we have people in the rural community, farmers listening, and a lot of town people listening, because we played right across New Zealand, sometimes twice a day. But if you're talking to fellow activists who do burn out sometimes, I know activists who've burnt out, sometimes I can hardly drag myself through the day. What is your advice to them?
Yeah, I'd say two things. One is just always have that bold vision, that big dream that we have in your heart. And the thing that keeps me driving forward is the fact that not only do I have this vision, but I know we can achieve it. And if you believe you can achieve it, if you believe in yourself, you believe in your allies, and you believe in this movement, if you believe in the rectitude of our cause, it'll keep you fighting. But the second thing is find people who care about you and who you care about. And, and that is a simple rule of happiness and purpose in life. Surround yourself with people who you believe in, who believe in you, who you're doing something great together with. And no matter how defeated, depressed, exhausted I am, I know I have an incredible team of activists like Almira Tanner and Priya Sahani and Tanya Campos and Cassie King and Matt Johnson, who's standing right next to me. I mean, these people keep me fighting every day because I know they're fighting too. And any time I need a break, you know, I'm lucky enough that I have great physical health and a lot of resources, so I don't need too many breaks. But when I do need a break, and I do need breaks occasionally, I've got so many great team members to hold me up, lift me up, support me, have a good time, make great vegan food together, and that will keep you sustained over a long time. So make sure you have a good community, because you know, a movement of one is not a movement. We need a movement of many people, and when you come together with the people around you, and it doesn't matter what neighborhood, what city, what state you're in, there are going to be people around you who care about animals, have love in their hearts. Find those people, bond with them, and fight together for a world that's better for all animals.
That's wonderful. I just really want to thank you again. Thank you for everything that you're doing for suffering animals, and thank you for how articulate you are, how clearly you speak about the work that you do and why you do it. You're changing hearts and minds. So I certainly hope that you can come on Safe and Sound again.
Sounds great. And thank you for all the work you're doing, because this world will change because all of us come together and speak for animals. So everyone who's doing their part, however small it is helping us make change that will transform the world for animals. So thank you all.
Thank you, Wayne. All the best.
Thank you. Good night.
You've been listening to Wayne Shong from Direct Action Everywhere. Wayne's a lawyer, a scholar, and a former geeky kid, and an articulate voice for voiceless animals. Please check out his website, directactioneverywhere.com, and if you can spare a few dollars, please click on the donate button. We'll go out on the track that we mentioned before by talented musician Jason Oliver. It's called Speak Out. Until next time, everyone, Matiwa. Bye-bye.
Violence, I will speak out loudly. soul, it burns in my soul to hear them in misery. I cannot be silent among these symbols of violence. No, I will not stay silent around all this violence. I will speak out loudly, speak out proudly. I will speak out loudly, speak out proudly. I will speak out even though my voice shakes. Speak out even though I'm afraid. Speak out boldly until everyone is free. Speak out, even though our voice shakes. Speak out,